Not a black car, either. Something that will not attract attention. Von Tissen stopped writing and shot a puzzled look. Are you in danger, Mr. Bachmann? Perhaps. I'm not sure, and I'm not taking chances. Von Tissen pondered this for a few seconds, then said, Would you like for us to make the airline reservations? Yes. Then I need to see your passport. Joel pulled out Giovanni's borrowed passport. Von Tissen studied it for a long time, his stoic banker's face betraying him. He was confused and worried. He finally managed, Mr. Bachmann, you will be traveling with someone else's passport? That's correct. And this is a valid passport? It is. I assume you do not have one of your own. They took it a long time ago. This bank cannot take part in the commission of a crime. If this is stolen, then I assure you it's not stolen. Then how did... Let's just say it's borrowed, okay? But using someone else's passport is a violation of the law. Let's not get hung up on U.S. immigration policy, Mr. Von Tissen. Just get the schedules. I'll pick the flights. Your girl makes the reservations using the bank's account. Deduct it from my balance. Get me a car and a driver. Deduct that from my balance if you wish. It's all very simple. It was just a passport. Hell, other clients had three or four of them. Von Tissen handed it back to Joel and said, Very well. Anything else? Yes, I need to go online. I'm sure your computers are secure. Absolutely. His email to Neil read, Grinch, with a bit of luck, I should arrive in U.S. tonight. Get a new cell phone today. Don't let it out of your sight. Tomorrow morning, call the Hilton, Marriott, and Sheraton in downtown Washington. Ask for Giovanni Ferro. That's me. Call Carl Pratt first thing this morning on the new phone. Push hard to get Senator Claiborne in D.C. We will cover his expenses. Tell him it's urgent, a favor to an old friend. Don't take no for an answer. No more emails until I get home. Marco. After a quick sandwich and a cola in Von Tissen's office, Joel Bachmann left the bank building riding shotgun in a shiny green BMW four-door sedan. For good measure, he kept a Swiss newspaper in front of his face until they were on the Autobahn. The driver was Franz. Franz fancied himself a Formula One hopeful, and when Joel let it be known that he was in somewhat of a hurry, Franz slipped into the left lane and hit 150 kilometers per hour. Chapter 32. At 1:55 p.m., Joel Bachmann was sitting in a lavishly large seat in the first-class section of a Lufthansa 747 as it began its pushback from the gate at Munich Airport. Only when it started to move did he dare pick up the glass of champagne he had been staring at for 10 minutes. The glass was empty by the time the plane stopped at the end of the runway for its final check. When the wheels lifted off the pavement, Joel closed his eyes and allowed himself the luxury of a few hours of relief. His son, on the other hand, and at exactly the same moment, 7:55 Eastern Standard Time, was stressed to the point of throwing things. How the hell was he supposed to go buy a new cell phone immediately, then call Carl Pratt again and solicit old favors that did not exist, and somehow cajole a retired and cantankerous old senator from Ocracoke, North Carolina, to drop what he was doing and return immediately to a city he evidently disliked immensely. Not to mention the obvious, he, Neil Bachmann, had a rather full day at the office. Nothing as pressing as rescuing his wayward father, but still a pretty full docket with clients and other important matters. He left Jerry's Java, but instead of going to the office, he went home. Lisa was bathing their daughter and was surprised to see him. What's wrong? She said. We have to talk. Now. He began with the mysterious letter postmarked from York, Pennsylvania, and went through the $4,000 loan, as painful as it was, then the smartphone, the encrypted emails, pretty much the entire story. She took it calmly, much to his relief. "You should have told me," she said more than once. "Yes, and I'm sorry." There was no fight, no arguing. Loyalty was one of her strongest traits, and when she said, "We have to help him," Neil hugged her. "He'll pay back the money," he assured her. "We'll worry about the money later. Is he in danger?" "I think so." "Okay, what's the first step?" "Call the office and tell them I'm in bed with the flu." Their entire conversation was captured live and in perfect detail by a tiny mic planted by the Mossad in the light fixture above where they were sitting. It was wired to a transmitter hidden in their attic, and from there it was relayed to a high-frequency receiver a quarter of a mile away in a seldom-used retail office space recently leased for 6 months by a gentleman from D.C. There, a technician listened to it twice, then quickly emailed his field agent in the Israeli embassy in Washington. Since Backman's disappearance in Bologna more than 24 hours ago, the bugs planted around his son had been monitored even more closely. The email to Washington concluded with, "JB's coming home." Fortunately, Neil did not mention the name Giovanni Ferro during the conversation with Lisa. Unfortunately, he did mention two of the three hotels, the Marriott and the Sheraton. Backman's return was given the highest priority possible. 11 Mossad agents were located on the East Coast. All were ordered to D.C. immediately. Lisa dropped their daughter off at her mother's. Then she and Neil sped south to Charlottesville, 30 minutes away. In a shopping center north of town, they found the office for U.S. Cellular. They opened an account, bought a phone, and within 30 minutes were back on the road. Lisa drove while Neil tried to find Carl Pratt. Aided by generous helpings of champagne and wine, Joel managed to sleep for several hours over the Atlantic. When the plane landed at JFK at 4:30 p.m., the relaxation was gone, replaced by uncertainties and a compulsion to look over his shoulder. At immigration, he at first stepped into line with the returning Americans, a much shorter line. The mob waiting across the way for non-U.S. was embarrassing. Then he caught himself, glanced around, began cursing under his breath, and hustled over to the foreigners. How stupid can you be? A thick-necked uniformed kid from the Bronx was yelling at people to follow this line, not that one, and hurry up while you're at it. "Welcome to America." Some things he had not missed. The passport officer frowned at Giovanni's passport, but then he had frowned at all the others, too. Joel had been watching him carefully from behind a pair of cheap sunglasses. "Could you remove your sunglasses, please?" the officer said. "Certamente," Joel said loudly, anxious to prove his Italianness. He took off the sunglasses, squinted as if blinded, then rubbed his eyes while the officer tried to study his face. Reluctantly, he stamped the passport and handed it over without a word. With nothing to declare, the customs officials barely looked at him. Joel hustled through the terminal and found the line at the taxi stand. "Penn Station," he said. The driver resembled Farouk Khan, the youngest of the three, just a boy. And as Joel studied him from the back seat, he pulled his briefcase closer. Moving against the rush hour traffic, he was at Penn Station in 45 minutes. He bought an Amtrak ticket to D.C. and at 7 left New York for Washington. The taxi parked on Brandywine Street in northwest Washington. It was almost 11, and most of the fine homes were dark. Backman spoke to the driver, who was already reclining and ready for a nap. Mrs. Pratt was in bed and struggling with sleep when she heard the doorbell. She grabbed her robe and hurried down the stairs. Her husband slept in the basement most nights, mainly because he snored, but also because he was drinking too much and suffering from insomnia. She presumed he was there now. "Who is it?" she asked through the intercom. "Joel Backman," came the answer, and she thought it was a prank. Who?